Over 30 years after the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade legalized abortion, Americans are still divided over it, and opponents are hoping it will be overturned. The decision was written by Harry Blackmun, who served in the Supreme Court from 1970 to 1994. He died 5 years after leaving the court. My guest Linda Greenhouse has written a new book about him called Becoming Justice Blackmun. It's based on his personal papers, correspondence, and case files. Greenhouse has covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times since 1978 and won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting in 1998. She appears regularly on the PBS program Washington Week in Review. Let's start with the Roe v. Wade abortion decision that Justice Blackmun wrote, a decision that is still not only controversial, perhaps even more controversial than ever. What was the state of the abortion law in the United States when the court agreed to hear Roe?
There was a lot of ferment building up in the country over abortion. It had been the case that abortion had been illegal for many decades in every state, but reform was in the air. New York in 1970 had liberalized its abortion law, making abortion essentially widely available within some limited restrictions. There was a reform effort in California. The attitude toward abortion was changing among the elites in the country, particularly among the medical establishment, which had been very anti-abortion for many years, but had come in recent years leading up to Roe against Wade to see abortion really as a public health issue, that the regime of illegal abortion was putting women in harm's way. There were always going to be unintended pregnancies. There were always going to be efforts to terminate those pregnancies. And the medical establishment had just very recently, before Roe reached the court, the American Medical Association, the American Public Health Association, a few other of these leading organizations had changed their policies and started calling for a change in abortion laws. And I think it's important to make that point because I think Roe against Wade has come in the public mind to stand for, women's rights or to sound like some kind of radical departure by the Supreme Court in 1973. And neither of those assumptions is really borne out by the actual history and certainly the record that was in Justice Blackmun's files as he started working on the case.
Justice Blackmun hadn't expressed an opinion before on abortion, and one of the things that he did to help guide and educate him was get back in touch with the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. He used to be the general counsel at the clinic, and he asked them to help him do research on this, and they opened up their library to him. How did that affect his decision?
Well, he was very interested in kind of seeing where what were the roots of the abortion debate in the medical community, what was the medical community's opinion on abortion. He was also very interested in tracking down the roots of the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take, first do no harm, who was it that was being harmed, and so on. So the Mayo Clinic actually volunteered to open its library to him and allow their researchers to do some background work for him, pulling together a lot of the recent articles that were appearing in medical journals about abortion. And he went out there and spent several weeks in the Mayo Clinic library in the summer after Roe against Wade was argued the first time. The court decided there was going to be a re-argument, and so that's the summer that he went out. It would have been the summer of 1972.
Harry Blackmun was pretty new to the Supreme Court when he wrote the Roe decision. How did he become the justice to write it?
He never actually was sure. He was assigned to write it by Chief Justice Warren Burger. The Chief Justice gets to assign an opinion in any case in which he himself is in the majority, and Burger was in the majority in Roe against Wade. In fact, it's worth noting that the vote in Roe against Wade, I think if you ask most people, they'd say, well, it must have been 5-4. It was 7-2. It really reflected a broad consensus on the court, and that's part of why Harry Blackmun was always so puzzled why he became the symbol of abortion in America, why he's the one that got the hate mail and the death threats and so on, because he spoke, he was assigned a case by the Chief Justice, and he spoke for a majority of the court. You know, it's possible that that Berger realized there'd be some flack to take, and maybe Blackmun, being the junior justice, was in the kind of the flack-catching position.
How do you think the language that Justice Blackmun used in his written decision has framed, has subsequently like framed the debate on abortion?
Well, there's two interesting points to make about the way he wrote Roe against Wade. One is it's clear when you look at it that this was basically a decision about the rights of doctors, the rights of doctors to act in what they consider to be their patient's best interest without risking going to jail. There are documents in his papers that indicate he was really very aware of what was happening to doctors. There's an article in his files from an obstetrician from Minnesota named Jane Hodgson, who was an alumna of the Mayo Clinic, and she wrote in the Mayo Clinic Alumni Magazine about her decision to perform an abortion on a patient who had contracted German measles early in pregnancy. And as you recall, that gave a very high risk of serious birth defects, and she performed the abortion knowing it was illegal. It was sort of an act of civil disobedience, but really she was trying to take good care of her patient, and she was charged with a crime, and she wrote about it. And she said in her article, "I look forward to the day when abortion is regarded as a humane service and not a crime." So he really did see a kind of a doctor-centric view. That's one answer to your question. Another answer, of course, is what kind of attention the court paid to the fetus, to the unborn life at stake in an abortion. And the blunt answer is it paid very little attention. And that's been obviously a source of criticism of the opinion ever since. When you look at the briefs that were filed to the court at that time, there really wasn't a whole lot of discussion about fetal life. And that wasn't kind of the framework through which the court, I won't say just Blackmun, the seven members of the majority were looking at all. And in fact, the two dissenters, Justice Rehnquist and Justice Byron White, did not frame their dissents in terms of the interests of the fetus on the other side of the equation, but rather as a dissent from what they viewed as the judicial activism of striking down all the abortion laws in the country. It was more of a critique of the judicial function than of the actual outcome. They, in the private conferences at the court, at least as reflected by the notes that Harry Blackmun took and left in his files, there was really nobody speaking up for the fetal side of the abortion debate, you might say.
Though Blackmun did say the state had two separate and distinct interests in the case. One was protecting the health of the woman, but the other was protecting the potentiality of human life. And he said that the state has an increasing interest as the woman comes to term.
Yes, that's the famous trimester formula that the court set out in Roe. And, you know, it's probably important to say this wasn't something that just popped out of Harry Blackmun's head. It was really a collaborative effort during the months leading up to the final decision among a number of the justices in the majority as to actually how the right to abortion would be implemented in practice. And they eventually came to this decision of the kind of moving framework that in the first trimester, the woman's right is essentially absolute because abortion is safer than carrying a pregnancy to term in the first trimester in the state. Has no regulatory role other than the role it would play in regulating any medical service, you know, a licensed physician and so on and so on. And then in the second trimester, because the medical equation makes the later abortion procedure more risky for the woman, the state can have more strictly medical regulation, not a prohibition, but can have a greater degree of flexibility and regulation. And then in the last trimester, abortion can be prohibited except to preserve the life or health of the pregnant woman.
You were given access to Harry Blackmun's papers before anyone else in the press was. You got, like, what, a two-month lead on the rest of
right,
the press?
Right, and Nina Totenberg for NPR also. And Nina and I both did.
How did this happen?
Well, when Justice Blackmun decided to give his papers to the Library of Congress, which many justices have done over the years, he gave it with the stipulation that the papers could be opened 5 years after his death. And that deadline was in March of 2004. And everybody knew that he had a fabulous set of papers. He never threw anything away. He took notes on everything. So people were really anticipating, you know, what was in there. The Blackmun family was concerned that on the opening day of the collection at the library's manuscript division, it would just be a big circus, you know, big feeding frenzy kind of thing. And they wanted to avoid that. So they approached me and with a proposition that I could go in there 2 months early, but not write anything at all until the public opening had occurred, at which time I could publish whatever seemed to me to be appropriate to publish. They weren't going to control it at all, but that was the deal.
I think a lot of people now are more likely to, you know, erase their emails or shred their papers than to save them for posterity. Do you think that in the future it's going to be hard to find a collection of papers like Justice Blackmun's?
Well, I think his papers are unusual because he was unusual in his determination to save everything. I think it was more reflects, you know, his personality rather than the time and place, although it's certainly true that the kind of correspondence, the handwritten correspondence that is in these files, it's very unlikely to be taking place today. I think for court papers, for papers generated by the Supreme Court's internal decisional process, those will remain on paper. I think the justices still do that instead of email. But whether individual justices decide to save that stuff and turn it over to the country, is going to be a very individual decision. And I think that the prevailing view on the court today is that a collection of papers should remain closed until everybody who that justice has served with has left the court or died. I think several of the incumbent justices have put that kind of stipulation on their papers when they've indicated a desire to give them to some library or other. And many of the justices felt that the 5 years that Blackmun set was too short.
Yeah, well, a lot of the people he served with are, well, everyone he served with is, everyone in the end who he served with is still there.
Except for Breyer, who replaced him, but yeah.
Right,
eight
exactly,
of the nine.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So do you think they're angry that the papers have been released?
Well, you know, angry may be putting it too strongly, but I don't think they liked it at all. And I think... I don't think any of them are going to do the same thing. You know, as it turned out, I think there's nothing in these papers that really is embarrassing to the court institutionally. I really didn't find anything like that. You know, they don't, the incumbent justices, I'm sure, don't like to read about themselves, you know, at all. But given that that was going to happen, I don't think there's anything here that really, you know, made them gnash their teeth all that much other than the simple fact of it occurring.
Well, Linda Greenhouse, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Linda Greenhouse reports on the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Her new book is called Becoming Justice Blackmun.